Well, it's Jerry Garcia, just, you know.
Oh, you came with
Jerry. Just because.
The color, just as green is the color for St. Patrick's Day, purple is the color for St. Arho. He was the patron saint of Finland who drove the grasshoppers out of Finland, saving the wine crop, and that's how you get to the purple.
First invented pesticides.
See, it was for economic development. I like it.
Yeah. The real fun part is to go try to find a bottle of Finnish wine.
Yeah.
Wait, no, it's better than
it can be difficult. Where do you find a bottle of Finnish wine?
Never have found one.
There were some bottles finished at our place.
Okay, we're ready now. Let's go. In all seriousness, Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development, good morning. It's Tuesday, March 18th, 2003. And at this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. With a tap of the gavel, we'll open a subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Good morning again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and both members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And what we wanted to do today was answer a few of the questions that arose yesterday. You have before you a packet of information, and if I could just walk through that, perhaps that can answer some of the questions that came up yesterday.
We didn't realize we'd ask that many questions.
But we've got information, Mr. Chair. Anyway, on the second page, you'll find an explanation and some of the facts about the Wage Security Fund, which, of course, was established for loss of plant or company closures that didn't have sufficient assets to pay final wages to its employees. Qualified applicants are paid from the fund for the amount that they earned during the 60 days preceding closure date of the business or the claimant's last day of employment up to a maximum of $4,000. The fund was established in 1985 and first payouts in July of 1986. The Bureau's paid out over $10.1 million of the fund to over 11,000 displaced workers. Money from the fund comes from a diversion of 0.03 of 1% of employment taxes collected during the second calendar quarter of every odd-numbered year. Employers don't pay this in addition to the taxes that they already pay. This is simply a diversion of that small percentage of the fund, which is expected to generate $9 million from the 0103 biennium. The funds amount equal, or the funds paid rather, equal the wages only. It doesn't cover sick leave or accrued compensation time. The average fund payment is $1,273 per worker. And just a couple other things I could tell you is that the it's paid to the Bureau in the seventh quarter of the biennium, so we get very low, and then there's a large payment into it. It does isn't paid for to us by the Employment Department. It is kept by the Employment Department in an interest-bearing account, and between the interest and those fees that are recovered, it pays for the administrative expenses of the three FTE that are paid from that fund. We do attempt to make recovery from those employers but are insolvent, being insolvent, there are oftentimes not funds available to collect back from them. So recoveries are rare and very small. On the next page, you'll see from 95 to 97 biennium through the 03-05 biennium, where the beginning cash balance is, the interest and recoveries, the transfers in from the Employment Department as they come in, and the total amounts available. The expenditures, the personal services, services and supplies, and payments to individuals column, and the total expenditures, as well as the ending cash balance. We're anticipated, as you can see in the 03-05 biennium, to have an ending balance of about $6,150,000. But I'd also point out, if you look at the payouts to individuals that we have had in the 03-05 governor's budget, it reflects a 113% increase in payments to those individuals. So there's been a dramatic increase, and certainly within this economy, we're not sure how many closures there will be. As well as, I've also mentioned yesterday that when we come to you with a 10% package that is of this administration rather than the previous one, one thing we want to look at is putting some administrative costs actually attributed to that fund for the administration that we do.
Real quickly, if you don't mind, it does appear that your ending balance is creeping up. Is there some limit to the amount that you can have in that ending balance, or is there an adjustment that needs to be made in the amount of diversion at this point in time?
Well, I would say that the trend, it has been creeping up, but what has also been creeping up is the number of closures. There really, I think what we need to do is take a look at this fund over a period of time, particularly right now in an economic downturn. I'd say by next biennium we'd have a better feel for how whether it is, and then actually probably come to the legislature with a recommendation of perhaps reducing it, the diversion amount or the diversion percentage, if we find that it's not necessary. But the fund hasn't been around for even 20 years yet, and it's hard to say whether that and also you have to remember that we have, where the fund gets to a low, the question yesterday that brought up the answer of $1.5 million is we try to keep it to no less than $1.5 million. And in doing so, to make sure that we have enough funds on hand, we only get one payment in the seventh quarter of the biennium out of eight quarters. And also, by having as much money in the funds as we do right now, the interest and recoveries are able to cover the three FTE that we have out of it without dipping into the fund. So I'd say that it's something we need to monitor, but right now it's doing an adequate job. And if I also could point out to you that in June of 1997, when we looked at the month by month, we did dip down to a low of $710,000 in that fund. The lowest this in 01, we got down to about $1.8 million, which if we continue to have plant closures, we could dip much below that, which of course would reduce the interest that we earn off the account, which would, you know, get the FTE working into the principal. And if we go on to the next, we have a couple of different handouts which show you some of the companies that have actually closed within the state and had employees draw upon those funds. These two charts, one from July 1st, 2001 to June 30th, 2002, it shows, you know, the number of employees that were paid out, what the cash payout was, what the company was that went basically insolvent within the state, and it gives you a feel for the money that comes out of that fund and the employees that are helped through that. And, Mr. Chair, if there are no questions on that one, we could go on to the questions on apprenticeship.
Okay.
So the next page within your handout, you'll see, is talks about apprenticeship overview. I think there are a couple things that I can cover on here that perhaps can help the committee. First, you know, what is apprenticeship? Apprenticeship actually is a combination. It's a career opportunity and gearing you toward a career, but it's a combination of on-the-job training as well as classroom education where apprentices can earn income as they learn. They start out generally at about 50% of what the journeyman scale would be. Committees are made up of both employees and employers, representatives from specific industries, and they operate those apprenticeship programs. Both state and federal government have a role in regulating those apprenticeship programs. Often we get asked, you have a, I think there's a question brewing there.
Well, there was one thing that caught both of us eye.
Sure, what was that?
Mr. Chair, is this?
Yes, Senator Duke.
Just surprise. I'm always surprised to see how many companies we turn over in a year. I know there are a lot of them, and I expect most of them to be small business. And I see Portland Bottling Company on here with 98 employees and $58,000 in payoff. And I guess I thought a business of that size and that longevity would have had the reserves to have covered their employees. So, plus, it's not like one night they decided to close. And I was also surprised, but then I reminded myself that Taco Times are franchises, so that the bigger company doesn't do anything to help necessarily to help the little one.
No, unfortunately, it does not. Those are separate little franchises, as most of McDonald's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and other operations like that are as well.
I guess the answer is to accept reality before you get to the point where your people are on the street with no income.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think the point that I made yesterday in saying that these are, by having these funds available and having the ability to pay these employees that otherwise wouldn't see any money, keeps them off of other government assistance and gets the infusion of cash in their hands that they have rightfully earned, that gets dollars into the tax system as well.
Do we have any reason to think that when a company's getting into the last moments that they aren't real concerned, some of them, about paying because they know this fund's there?
I think that might be a
question. Do you ever find people who say my employer directed me in your direction?
Senator Dukes, Chair George, for the record, my name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. Actually, we get good cooperation from employers. Sometimes they work with us as they're closing and to the very end and try to come up with money if they can, but provide us the records that we need to determine what the payouts are. We frequently file claims in bankruptcy court to try to recover money, and sometimes we do collect some money back on the dollars for the fund that are paid out. The employers are generally cooperative. We do occasionally have them say, sorry, I can't pay you, go to the Bureau of Labor, but... Yes.
They're in both of these pay periods. There's 98 employees in one and 117.
Yeah, 2 years.
Mm-hmm. So it was a bigger crash than what you see on one report.
Well, then it doesn't seem like if they have a second one that they should have been able to pay the first ones?
Senator Dukes, they were continual. I mean, they just happened across two different fiscal years, but it was a process of several processing all those wage claims over that two-year period.
But this liability does flow into the bankruptcy proceedings?
Yes, it does.
That's good.
I think we are back to apprenticeship, Mr. Chair.
That's
See, I'm learning along the process here as well. So that gets us to one of the more frequently asked questions of what is an apprenticeship committee and who are the members of the committee. Local joint apprenticeship committees are recognized by the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council pursuant to the statute. And joint management labor committees are responsible for the evaluating the training needed within the given occupation that the apprenticeship council set up for, and selecting apprentices and determining how the on the job and the classroom instruction is done by the committee. The committee's meet regularly and evaluate apprentices and monitor the committee's compliance with both state and local regulations. And members are nominated by the employers group and the employees group and utilize utilize the apprenticeship program.
Dan, does Boley support financially any of the council operations, or that they're basically being paid for by the employer's employees?
Mr. Chair, actually, I believe it, I can't remember if it was 1997 or 1999. I probably should remember. I think I carried the bill to the floor. But basically, prior to that point in time, apprenticeship councils were considered state agencies. They had support from the Attorney General's office. They were insured by the state. There was a movement, I believe it was in 1997, to make them standalone committees, that they should have the ability to rise or fall on their own merit. And actually, if you look at trends over time and the number of apprenticeship committees, as Steve Sims mentioned yesterday, there was a major cleanup during that period of time of the number of apprentices that were carried on books, and the number of apprenticeship committees out there greatly reduced, because at that point in time they were no longer state agencies. We no longer sent staff in to help to run them. The Bureau went into a compliance mode of making sure that those committees met all of the standards, but they were no longer state agencies. And so we don't really put a dime into those committees. Mm-hmm. Other than we have staff time that goes in and does compliance reviews, works with those committees, and helps them in their process. And I'm sure Steve will have something to add to that.
Well, good morning, Senator George, committee members. I would just like to say, I think the state does.
You need to state your name for the record.
Stephen Sims. I'm the director for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. I think the state does put a substantial amount of resources in the committee, because in addition to performing compliance reviews, we provide technical assistance to those committees, and we attempt to assist them not only in monitoring their workforce needs, but in doing EEO outreach and reviewing their curriculum, and in trying to help them strengthen their relationship with local community colleges. So we do our share of in-kind contributions to the local programs.
Mr. Chair, I guess my point only is we do not hand them dollars.
Okay.
That was
That's
what your
correct.
Question was.
That's correct. Thanks.
On the back side of the first page, you can see what a joint labor management committee's primary role is and how the committee's obligated to fulfill the duties set forth in the statute, and it outlines what those duties are, and determining whether employers maintain safe and adequate facilities and establish affirmative action plans to keep in compliance with the EEOC. And I'm glad you don't have the piggy bank with the acronyms, because I'd owe you $20. But anyway. They also determine whether it should be they should accept applicants for new apprentices, and they recruit and evaluate qualified applicants. And as you can see, they have a full series of steps to go through there as well. How does a joint labor management committee decide to offer new apprenticeship opportunities? Most of the local committees monitor industry trends, and they evaluate the local economy and survey their participants, the contractor groups within there, to see how many apprentices are necessary to keep with the workload demands based upon the industry at the time. And as I've said, those committees are balanced between both employer and employee, and they set up a number of what the target number is for apprentices to be taken into that program on those bases. On the next page, you can see the total number of apprentices has decreased in the past few years, and mostly for the economy, but also because of straightening up of some of those lists. And there's also talks about how during the Gulf War recession of the 90s, total registrations declined steadily to a low of 4,972 apprentices was reached in fiscal year 92-93, and a gradual increase of registrants after that point. Next page, you can see apprenticeship completions across the different years. And also, most of the programs, you know, also decrease the number of new applicant opportunities there, so you can see how those are. The secondary reason for the decrease in registrations was the council's decision to focus on program quality and compliance of apprenticeship and rules and regulations based on the 97 change in legislation we talked about earlier. They also indicate numbers of apprentices registered with state-approved programs that were no longer active because between 97 and 2000, over 4,300 apprenticeship registrations were canceled, and the division estimates that 20% of those cancellation of registrations were for individuals who were not actively been employed as apprentices for at least a one-year period.
Senator Dooms?
The list of requirements, I guess, or criteria that we have for these councils to follow.
These are for the committees, yeah.
Committees. Is impressive. But one of the things I wondered as I was reading it, it says, evaluate apprentices' work experience and education on a regular basis to determine whether they are progressing towards completion. And then I'm real curious about the affirmative action plan and equal employment opportunity goals that they all have. But then I'm looking at the numbers, and if between 97 and 2000 they had over 4,300 who were canceled, some of those because they hadn't been in it for at least a year, makes me wonder how well they're following the printed stuff, how well they're evaluating the work experience and education to see what kind of progress we're making. Sounds like maybe we start out good and then we leave them out there and lose track of them. How can you know whether you got enough apprentices coming on if you're not keeping better track of them?
Well,
Your answer is that now we are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, absolutely. Now we are. I think the point is that there were a number of committees out there that were not performing their duties and obligations. And when the legislation changed in 1997 to make them stand alone, to make them rise or fall on their own, those committees that were not performing and not doing a job basically folded tents. And
who evaluates them on these criteria to see if they're doing these things?
We do that through the compliance reviews, and Steve can, you know, tell you if you want to tell them a little bit about what is in the compliance reviews. And
certainly. Division staff conducts compliance reviews of all of our registered programs. The compliance package is approximately a 34-page questionnaire divided into two sections. One is program operations, which would basically deal with the quality of related training, whether or not the apprentices are being rotated through all the different work processes for the various operations, committee structure, whether the committee's reviewing its apprentices and its curriculum on a regular basis. The other part is the EEO affirmative action review. That's basically whether or not the committee has a valid legal selection procedure, whether or not it has an affirmative action plan, and whether or not it's actually reviewed and acted upon its affirmative action plan. Staff conducts the review and then makes a recommendation as to whether or not the committee should be approved or whether or not it should be sanctioned to the council, and the council makes the final decision as to what actions taken with respect to the committee.
34-page questionnaire?
Correct.
That seems awfully long. So the EEOC thing is basically they can go out and recruit in whatever area they want to, but if somebody who fits into EEOC happens to stumble their way, then they have to treat them fairly?
Senator Dukes, I think that the EEO plan works in conjunction with the selection method. And one thing that staff and the council tries to do is make sure, pursuant to federal law, that the local committee adopts a fair and objective selection procedure based upon criteria related to the probability of success in the job. And it looks at criteria such as, in some cases, there are validated aptitude tests. In others, you look at prior work experience, prior education, prior training. They then create a list of individuals, a ranked list, and in order to create an objective criterion, you select from the top of the list in ranked order. Again, you're using those scores. The selection methods also have exceptions. Exceptions by law are only supposed to be in order to increase compliance with the EEO plan. So, for example, you can have an exception to the selection method that states if you are recruiting from Job Corps, as we discussed yesterday. Job Corps is anticipated to have a greater number of women and ethnic minorities. You may select individuals from there. So that's your selection procedure. In addition to that, you're required to have an EEO outreach plan that indicates that you will do recruitment and outreach. The federal regulations set 7 areas where you should be doing outreach. We require each committee to submit an affirmative action plan that indicates that they're doing some type of outreach activity in each of those 7 areas.
So basically, the system that is in place, I mean, that boys tend to take shop and all of that kind of stuff, we're perpetuating that.
If I may, Senator Dukes, I think that's part of the problem, and I think as Commissioner Gardner stated yesterday, in addition to putting more pressure on our committees to search out those qualified women and minorities who are apprenticeship ready right now, we need to make a bigger pitch at the elementary and high school level about teaching shop math, about teaching trade awareness, and letting students know that these are opportunities that pay $30,000, $40,000, $60,000 a year. There's a lot more that we need to have the committees actively engaged with the education system to say, you're missing out on something. And more importantly, even if you want to go to college, most of our apprenticeship programs result in an associate's degree. You are in college.
I know from experience it's not a difficult thing to do, and it's not real time-consuming to get information out there to different people. And you don't have to send even staff out to do it once the information is out there and to the right people.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, if I could add just a couple of things. One of the initiatives we're looking at is, you know, we are in the technological information superhighway out there. Like it or not, I was taken into a kicking and screaming, but I'm getting there. I think one of the things we're looking for is more direct links to the high schools to be able to get the information about those opportunities out there.
Kind of training going on at the community colleges.
And one thing I'd certainly, if any of a member of the committee is interested, one of the new things that's come on in the last few years is the Women in the Trades Fair that goes on in the Tri-County area every single year. Connie Ashbrook is a member of the Apprenticeship Training Council, oversees the Women in the Trades program, and we've been, working very closely with them. They put on a major show for several days once a year, and they actually bus in young women from various different high schools in the area, and they set up different areas for each and every one of the crafts and bring in women in those crafts to show them what the craft is about, what the opportunities are within that particular apprenticeship training program. Some of them actually have a hands-on display. I know my local IBEW Local 48 happens to have, they show you how to wire a different circuit and what, about the electricity. Some of the carpenters groups make different, wood items and give them a bit of a flavor, a bit of a hands-on effect. And they have the women there who actually work in the profession to tell them what it's like and to help let them know that there is a support group out there for those women who want to get into the trades, to give them help and assistance from those who've been through it.
Yeah, and I that's good. I tend to come at this from a little different way. I simply want you to recruit from all the areas, not just the traditional ones. To get into where a whole broad spectrum of people are to let them know that this is available. Now, maybe that what you were just talking about is necessary to jumpstart some things and get the numbers up, but it's better as a matter of course that we don't target one group or another. We just target everybody who might, for any reason, you know, want to be in here. And if you've got 188 trades, you ought to be able to find something for just about anybody. So,
Mr. Chair,
you know, Senator, beat this horse yesterday. I'm just saying that the stuff that looks good on paper doesn't always produce results, and this doesn't seem to be doing a real good job of producing results. And especially if you're sending out a 34-page questionnaire, I wouldn't want to fill out a 34-page questionnaire on what I'm doing. I'm sure their response is, leave me alone, we're doing fine. That maybe we need to look at not just meeting the letter of the federal law, but rather the recruitment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I would wholeheartedly agree with you, and I think that there is a reason why the Bureau went to mostly compliance reviews for a period of time, because we did have those committees that were not performing, and we needed to see that. And the concentration I've talked about is looking at completion rates. Those that have completion rates within the apprenticeship and training programs that have high completion rates are those that are performing fairly well. And rather than doing a yearly review of each and every program as we're doing now, I'd like to see the council move toward doing compliance reviews, looking at completion rates. If you've got for instance, a 60% or higher completion rate, rather than doing a compliance review every year, maybe once every 5 years, and do a mini report to give us the stats and numbers we need in the meantime. If you got a 50 to 60% completion rate, then once every 3 years, for instance. And if you got lower than a 50% completion rate, those are the programs we need to concentrate on and make sure that they're bringing them up. But that'll also give me the ability to redirect a little bit of the staff toward exactly the programs you're talking about and doing more outreach rather than being just that of compliance, being that of assisting those programs to go out into the communities and attract more qualified applicants from all fields and from all ethnic and minorities as well. So,
before we go to Senator Morris, while we're on this subject, if you take a look at the registrations on page 3, and then you look on page 4 at the completions, the percentage of women minorities, does it end up at the end with those who completed being a similar percentage to those who entered the programs?
Senator George, I did not bring those stats with me, but I can tell you that for ethnic minorities, the completion rates for minorities lag maybe 1 to 1.5% behind those for the general apprenticeship population. Unfortunately, the completion percentage for women is approximately 30% behind the general completion rate.
You're not screening well. Somebody's not screening well.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just point out to you that there's an inconsistency in your numbers, and I'm not sure which ones are correct. 3 of 8, listing the 99-01 time period, those numbers are not consistent with the numbers in your governor's detail. So I just point that out. I'm not sure which ones are accurate. But my question is, what is the relationship between the community college apprenticeship programs and the council programs?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Senator Morris, we run registered apprenticeship programs, and most of our registered apprenticeship programs are affiliated with the community college. In almost every case, regardless of whether or not an apprenticeship committee has its own training center or not, in almost every case, every apprenticeship committee takes its curriculum to the local community college, has the local community college review the content, the anticipated outcome, review the qualifications of the instructors, determines whether or not the program sponsor, the committee, is offering adequate pre-servicing and in-servicing to those instructors, and the community college makes a determination as to whether or not that class would be suitable for a community college offering. If it decides that that class is suitable for a community college offering, it is then credentialed as a community college course, and the apprentice gets credit for it. In about 45% of our programs, the program sponsor, the committee, has its own training facility, has its own instructors, has its own curriculum, and so the instruction is delivered off-site, and the instruction is simply certified by the community college. In the other 55% of the cases, the actual instruction is offered on-site on the community college campus, and of course, all of those offerings would meet the accreditation requirements of the community college.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The funding for the community college program, is it through BOLI or is it through community college funding?
Senator Moore's committee, I certainly wish that it was through BOLI, but it's not. The community college, the apprenticeship classes offered at the community colleges are treated like any other community college offering. In other words, FTE is determined both for the on-campus offering and for the courses offered in the private sponsors' training centers. FTE amount is then paid out individually to each local community college. In some cases where the private sponsor has their own training center and their own curriculum, the community college may reimburse some funds back to the local trust fund that supports the apprenticeship committee to pay to defray a portion of the cost for instructors, facilities, etc. In all other cases, the community college, of course, keeps those funds and uses it to put on the apprenticeship program, and that's supplemented, of course, by the local tax base and also any tuition paid by the apprentices.
Thank you. Those that go through the community college track, are they in any way denied access in the same way that they would be through the council track?
Senator Morris, no. That community college education, once it's approved, the great thing about our relationship with the Office of Community Colleges is that we depend upon them to certify the academic integrity of the courses that are being offered. We don't have adequate staff, or I would even dare say our staff's not qualified to make that judgment on the academic quality of the offerings. So we rely on the community college making that certification. So any program on-site or at a local training center that's approved by the Office of Community Colleges is fully recognized by the State Apprenticeship Council.
Maybe I'm not clear, but if someone goes through the community college track, are the qualifications for acceptance different through the community college track as opposed to the council track? In terms of getting into the program at the community college level, how does that work versus through the council level? And maybe I'm not understanding the interrelationship.
I guess the best way to look at it, Senator Morris, is that the council approves all apprenticeship programs in the state, and its concern is not whether or not training is offered at a private site or at a community college. Its concern is whether or not the academic integrity of the education is suitable for the Office of Community Colleges. So it doesn't make any distinction between whether or not it's an on-site offering at the community college or programs offered by a private sponsor at its training facility. And I'm not sure that I'm getting at your question either.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I can take a stab at this one. Basically, how it works is that every single apprenticeship program has an apprenticeship training committee. They have their own selection process. There are those that have their own training facilities. There are those that use the facilities of a community college. The community college approves the curriculum of the program for it to be accredited. They provide the facilities and in some cases provide the instructors. But those that are applicants, those that are apprentices going through those programs, all are selected through the committee process. You can't just go into a community college and sign up to be an apprentice. Okay.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the underlying kind of tensions in this arena, government should work real hard to make sure that there's a level playing field between everybody. One of the concerns I hear from the union apprenticeship program, because they're all totally supported and totally funded by payroll taxes there or charges that are levied on both the journeymen and the employers, is that they pay for their own programs totally. And you see the electricians and the plumbers' training facilities are just incredible. I mean, it's almost like if you had a dedicated school that was just shop. But they've also got computer capacity, drawing capacity. I mean, it's a pretty incredible setups. But there's the feeling that the non-union employers that are going using community college facilities aren't really receiving a subsidy from the community colleges, and that this is I don't know, it's probably something that we will never really work out, but it's certainly perceived by the union people as being an unfair, well, not just the unions, but the union contractors that are paying a big chunk of the bills, that their competitors are getting a subsidy for their training component. And I've heard that listed as much if you looked over the whole state. I've heard estimates as high as $7 million a year in terms of that the community colleges are using to shore up these other programs. Now, whether that's I've tried to look into it, and I can't figure out how you really determine. It takes so much work to determine how much that subsidy really is that it's pretty hard to get at. But certainly, that's the perception that we don't have an even playing field now.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, if I could just expound upon that a little bit. One of the things that Steve and I have talked about doing, what we do right now is when a new program is set up, we look at how they're going to fund the program. But we don't, within any of the compliance reviews, look at how that program is funded past that point once they've been set up. One of the things I'd like to look at in future compliance reviews is look at their funding and see how it's funded. Although it's not 100% across the board, most cases in one that is organized or a union apprenticeship program, they're funded through a trust fund, both paid into equally by the employer and the employee and privately funded. Most of the non-union programs are funded through the community college system, as well as charging the applicant, the student, the apprentice, a fee per quarter, which oftentimes is higher than that of what you would be charged for one semester hour at a normal community college, and very little, if any, donation, if you will, into the fund from the employer. If that adds any clarity whatsoever. But we are looking at, you know, through the compliance review process, the potential of looking at how does each one of these fund, you know, these programs, how are they funded, and how much do they put in per student for that education, to do some comparisons across the board and see, you know, what is exactly happening out there, because we don't look at it right now other than when the new program is set up. New administration, new ideas, I don't know. Anyway, if there are no further questions, we can go on to the next section.
Well, Commissioner, the only thing I would be concerned about, and I'm still trying to get that whole thing straight in my mind, but that there would not be anything that would be a discouragement to any person who might want to go into trades, whether they're going to end up being an apprentice program and being a union or not, whether that person would like to pursue that education, I think should never be anything that would be infringed upon. That person can pursue that at their level and their desire.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with you, and I would, you know, never be party to trying to do anything to infringe upon any apprentice applicant from any segment of society in their ability to apply for a program. I think if you look back in the history of apprenticeship, I'm a third-generation electrician, and it probably comes to nobody's surprise that it used to be very much a, for lack of a better term, a good old boy network, and it is no longer that way today, and I would like to make sure that it continues to no longer be that type of a system and make sure that everyone has a fair shake at getting into those programs.
Senator Dukes.
Then you wouldn't mind providing us the makeup of these screening committees, would you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, the makeup of the committee, you mean who are the actual members of each and every one of the apprenticeship training councils of all 188 of them across the state? That would be a matter of public record, I believe.
I figure it would be.
Yeah.
I
believe we could.
I mean, if there's nothing to discourage people from coming in, I'd be real curious. I mean, your answer was very clear about how you get into a community college program, and it's no different than getting into the union programs. There is a committee there that decides whether you get to go and whether your training is adequate and your body mass is adequate and all of those wonderful things and whether or not there's a chance. I mean, it's legitimate whether they think you can survive the 3 or 4 years it takes and come out at the other end. And they're also taking a look at your IQ and as it relates to that particular field and all those kinds of things. So I'm just kind of curious as to who the people are. If indeed there's nobody there who's going to discourage you because you're not white or because you're a woman, I was just kind of curious as to how many non-whites and women we had in there in those screening committees.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I'd be happy. I believe that's a matter of public record, and I think that as long as it is, I'd be happy to provide that to the committee. And the one thing I will say is that one piece of it you might not be getting as well is we set up through the council different types of criteria you can select in setting up your committee. We don't give them an actual pattern of, hey, here's how you run an apprenticeship program, but there are different types of programs, and they can take from different segments and piece together their own type of program. One of the segments of that is called the selection process, and what process you use to select apprentice applicants. And you can set up different criteria. As we talked about yesterday, one of the criteria I'd like to see changed over time, although we don't have the authority to do this, it would be more of getting the committees to the point where they wish to, is most of them have requirements, for instance, that you be 18 years of age and you have a high school diploma, which can be a barrier from a young person going directly from high school into a program. I'd love to see them change to where the applicant has to be at least 17 years of age and within 6 months of graduation so that you can have the ability, at least if you've got the right individual, to have that seamless transition from high school directly into a program. But there are different types of selection process. I know as one who participated on both sides of the table in a selection process, both as an apprentice applicant and as a screener on an apprenticeship and training committee, there are processes where you can do individual interviews with each apprentice. You can do a pre-entrance test to make sure they have the math and science skills, etc. Some have in the past, and I can't remember how many of these have been determined to be discriminatory or no longer used, but in the past there have been things such as color blindness tests. I don't believe we do that one anymore. Believe it or not, that was found to be discriminatory, although it's a little difficult for me to understand as an electrician how you're supposed to tell the red from the green. But anyway, there were age limit tests. Plumbers, it works okay, you know. Anyway, There were also were tests of age. I know when I was first an applicant for the apprenticeship, you had to be no more than 24 years of age unless you were in the military. You'd get 4 years of credit for every year you were in the military, up to 4 years of credit. So we maximum took in 28-year-olds into the program. Age discrimination is taking care of those criteria. But to get more at this, there are things, and there were different barriers like that that have gone away. There are still different selection processes, from the blind random type of process, which Steve could probably outline a little better than I could. There's the ranking order process, where you take someone through, you can do an entrance test to make sure they have the basic elementary skills, and then they go through an interview process where both members from labor and from business interview that person and see that they truly are interested in this profession and that they actually know that, you know, it's not always, you know, for instance, in the electrical field, making up a panel in a nice clean room with a light over your head and no rain falling on you, but you actually can get out in the ditch and get muddy and dirty, and it's not always the most fun. I can personally attest to that, and I'm sure Representative Hansen could as well, although from a much lower skilled profession. But anyway, but anyway.
Well, your toilet backs up.
Got to get him in when I can. Sorry. He'll get me back later. Anyway.
I'm working with you, Representative.
But anyway, I think that actually is one of the fairest processes that's out there, is to be able to interview that applicant and to do them in a ranking order through an interview process. Those that use the blind random do so, for instance, because of more legal reasons. It is much harder to sue an apprenticeship committee for discrimination if you use a blind random process. But it's a fairer process to use ranking order. So there are different types of selection processes that different programs go through. If that's any help or just murkies the water, I'm not sure.
It's all interesting information, but no offense, but you came through a good old boy system.
I will tell you.
It worked for you.
I will tell you one thing, Senator Dukes, is that most people don't probably know this, but I didn't go through the apprenticeship in the state of Oregon. I did in the state of Illinois. And I will tell you, at the time, my grandfather was the 12th member of the local when it started. By the time, of course, I went through the apprenticeship program, he was deceased. My father was the assistant business manager, and my uncle was the largest contractor in that part of the state.
You had trouble getting an apprenticeship, did you?
It took me 3 years of applying to get into that program, Senator Dukes. So it is not as much of a good old boy network system as you think it is, even in the days when I went through over 20 years ago.
That's pathetic. That much cloud
of Mr. Chair,
we're back to level now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, all I can tell you is I had a lot of fun in high school.
So we had to bring you up in the math and sciences. Just don't just show you anybody can make it.
Huh? And I did have to go through several courses at the community college before the third time applying to be accepted.
If you two go at it any further, we're making it. Are we ready to proceed? We're going to be a short meeting today.
We're still working on shortening it here, Mr. Chair. If we can go on to the goals of the council, it really is to safeguard the welfare of the registered apprentices, as we were just talking about a little bit there, and to make sure that we have a highly skilled, competitive workforce and that they remain competitive on issues of quality. And the council believes that one measure of quality of the program is how effective its graduates complete the apprentices. There's a number of studies that have been done on this, we want to make sure that we have a better trained workforce to get the job done faster, with the greatest attention on detail, quality, and safety. That's what keeps the cost of construction down and keeps us making sure we're building more facilities out there. If we could skip down to question 8, one of the questions that came up yesterday was how many union, how many non-union programs. I believe that was Senator Morris's question. You can see here that there are 77 union programs, 63 non-union programs, and 28 mixed. It also shows you how many active apprentices are in there, what the completion rates were for those programs. Although the one thing I'll say about the completion rates is we do have another chart a little later on that it's not the most accurate and true picture until you look through the different programs on an individual basis. Completion rates over a five-year period, you can see that overall they're very close there. There was a question yesterday about apprenticeable occupations. We have a rather extensive and lengthy list there. I believe there is somewhere in the neighborhood of 80-some-odd programs there. There's also an abbreviations key just to avoid that $20 I might otherwise owe for too many acronyms, but or abbreviations. On the next page that you have, you can see attachment B, or appendix B, attachment 1, that shows over here, this is a sampling of some of the different programs. For instance, the top one, an inside electrical, sorry, E becomes before P, so electrical is before the plumbing there. The current apprentices are 422. The completion rate for program 1004 is 86.39%. Over 5 years, it's 81.72. The completion rate trade for 2002 for the overall trade is 74.49. And as you can see by looking at these completion rates, you can see that's why I think it's the best yardstick we can use for not encumbering those programs that have high completion rates with the long surveys that Senator Dukes was talking about, the long compliance reviews, rather, other than on a every so year, so many year period. And concentrate on those that have lower completion rates to see that those programs are brought up in quality so that we are graduating the best quality workforce out there that we can. This doesn't encompass all of the programs. That's only a sampling. It does take some time, and that's what we're able to comply or to compile, rather, overnight. On the next sheet, you'll see one of our least favorite programs. I mean, the plumbing program. And, okay, I'll quit with the plumbing joke. Anyway, and you can see that actually, you know, they have a very high completion rate as well in those programs and a 77% overall completion rate in those as well. And there's sheet metal on the back side as well. That's one that has, as you can see, a somewhat lower completion rate. So one that needs a little bit more work on the back side of that next page. And if you go to the last, I believe it's the last three pages of your handout, you can see this is a quarterly report that we produce every single quarter on performance indicators on overall programs. It gives you a several-year spectrum of the number of apprentices and what the actual performance is over on the right-hand side of the first quarter and second quarter of the year. And the percentage of the cumulative projection percentages across that area. It shows new registrants, completions, cancellations, the number of women, the percentage of women, the number of minorities, percentage of minorities, and total employees. This is just a quarterly report that's produced by the Bureau every single quarter and gives you how many new employees, how many new committees, new programs, dissolving committees, dissolving programs, and gives you a good snapshot in time of this particular quarter and where we're at with things and a perspective over time. So that one, rather than answer any questions you have on it. It's just interesting information and data that we have that you could look through at your leisure. That's as short as I can make it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chair, this is policy, kind of a big picture question. Looking at the breakdown in sources of funding, it would appear that there's a very high dependence on general fund, and I'm wondering as a policy question why general fund should be funding exclusively employment-related activities and putting the general fund, like for example, education in competition with BOLI activities. I don't see the connection, and I'm wondering if there is an opportunity for maybe thoughtful discussion about the source of funding for BOLI, tying it exclusively to labor employment as opposed to general fund. And I don't know whether that discussion has happened in the past or what the expression of the committee would be with respect to looking at that issue. But I raise it as it seems to me to be a overly dependent upon general funds for things that are very specifically focused to labor and employment.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, we are 57% dependent upon the general fund, although as I pointed out yesterday, there is a number of fees, there's a number of fines that we do generate, there's a number of dollars that we do recover, both in state and federal revenue as well, that does not come back into BOLI. Those fees and fines, for instance, either go into the general fund, the common school fund, or the housing trust fund, and that's what the legislature has, you know, set up to do with it. One comment you made, Senator, is in competition with education. We're in no way, shape, or form in competition with education. What we do is to help to assist those apprenticeship training programs in coordination with community colleges, where they take care of the curriculum and where it's what they're most suited for, and we take care of setting up what an apprenticeship committee is and the aspects and elements of it through legislation that's been in effect for a number of years.
From your side of the table, you're not in competition. From this side of the table, there is a lot of competition for these general fund dollars, and that's the reason I raised that issue. In more normal times, you know, it might not even be worth discussion. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that we reduce BOLI's budget. That's not the point of the discussion. The point is the equity of the source of funding, particularly when we're looking at critical shortfall in other areas than funding those, like education. So in a sense, it puts you in competition with those other services.
Commissioner, if you could provide for us a kind of a balance sheet of how many dollars flowed into the general fund, I think that might have helped to clarify that issue for us. You probably are our number one budget as far as the percentage of the budget that is, in fact, general fund. And there's a reason to be concerned about the question, you know, that Senator Morris has raised based upon the instruction we're being given. So I'd like to see that the flow in and the flow from the general fund. Just to kind of clarify for you. Senator Dukes?
Well, I was going to point out that the apprenticeship programs are education. And it doesn't sound like we're putting a lot into the apprenticeship programs, but they're no different than going to WOO, I guess it is now. To me, it's still WASC, for a teacher's certificate, or going to the University of Oregon for a degree that, you know, qualifies you to take the test to become a lawyer. They're preparing you for a trade, and so to me that's to earn money, and that's what most of the stuff in our K-12 and higher ed are all about. And I was going to ask, Senator, if you didn't want to cut their budget and you were concerned about the general fund, are you suggesting that business should be paying more?
Mm-hmm. That then is the following question, is should it be funded just for the payroll across the board? Because it is payroll, strictly payroll-related activities, it seems to me. And this is a big policy issue. I just picked education. I could have picked human services or, you know,
I guess I need to see how the payroll thing worked, because somehow taking money out of the employee's paycheck to pay just in case they get let go by a company that then takes off to another state didn't seem fair to me.
Okay, payroll is a vehicle, whether the distribution is employer, employee, that's...
Yeah, and that's the piece I would want to see.
Commissioner, if you could... I just asked Robin if she'd like to address this, and she said, not now. And so, so following the lead of the co-chairs and the vice-chair, would you take a look at the concept that Senator Morris is talking about as to whether an alternative method and what your recommendation would be if something like that were to develop in the near future?
Well, we can't develop here.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to provide. It may take us a bit to get together to that report that you were talking about for how much we generate. We are changing a lot of the accounting systems, and some of that is hard to capture, and we're trying to get as much of that as we can. So it may take us a little bit of time to do that. As far as bringing you an alternative, I could bring you a dozen alternative ideas. Senator George, I'm not sure how many. I'll leave the politically feasible part up to you.
Right, that's right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I would recommend is that when we are ready to go into work session, that we have at least some alternatives available for you to look at. Maybe prior to that, but right. At least that could be the focus of the discussion in work session. But there are a number of different issues here, and I think we need to have some time to look at what the ramifications are, among other things, but also what's feasible.
Certainly. And Mr. Chair, one thing I just can't miss the opportunity to interject one small thing as far as an idea that I've been working on in order to make BULI less dependent upon general funds, and that is a proposal that I have in the legislature to bring the Department of Business and Consumer Services Building Codes Division into BULI, which is an other-funded portion, and I think that in doing so, that will give us more ability to be less general fund obligated. And it ties together the duties not only of apprenticeship, where we take a first young person through a 1-5 year apprenticeship program, and then when they go into building codes division, if they're in a licensed craft such as plumbing or electrical, I'll give him one, their continuing education goes into the building codes division. By putting those together, not only are we adding to more streamlining and seamlessness of government, but we're relating duties together, and we're also would make BULI less dependent upon the general fund and help us to have other facilities across the state, because building codes division's offices happen to be in Hood River, Pendleton, and Coquille, which is a couple of areas where we've lost offices and where we could co-house and reduce infrastructure, which is certainly one of the key elements, you know, I'm looking at even within the 10% reduction recommendation that we bring to you. So that's a key piece of legislation to look at that may help and assist, and probably would be the number one recommendation of those 10 or 12 I'll bring back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any further questions?
Well, I just want to point out that all these alternatives may be great, and I'm happy to take a look at them, but they need to start down in hearing room A, because I don't think that this agency gets to raise its own fees. Well, they've changed some of the ways and means way of doing business this session, but I don't think we get to control the beginning and the end of everything like that. So,
yes,
just quick comment. Far be it for me to be critical of of the commissioner. But yes, yesterday he did point out that he felt he was the only labor commissioner to ever go through a certified apprenticeship program. And I think possibly he should do some research in terms of Commissioner Nielsen, who served, I believe, 16 years and, of course, was a plumber.
Somebody did his research. Oh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, touche.
Straight flush.
The only question I would have, are you sure he went through a program?
You know, you think I didn't understand this thing right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
okay.
Before we get any deeper, Mr. Chair.
Is there anything further to be presented to the committee or questions the committee might have? Okay, if not, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526 and end the bickering. Thank you.